Good afternoon and welcome to Holden Village. This afternoon in the fireside room, Bob Ekblad and Lars Clausen will continue their study reconstructing a workable theology. This afternoon's session is entitled New Models for Activism. It is CLA 2000-5. Let's listen in and hear what they have to say.
For all are part of this week. This is the last of the sessions that we have. Yesterday, friends came from Pennsylvania, and today, Sonia Holland. So, well, just a brief kind of a review is that for each of the
bells.
Oh, we did ring it.
Okay.
Yeah. Thanks, Dad.
I didn't hear it.
We've been trying to look at what's popular theology. What is sort of the popular way that we view God, and then looking in the scriptures, and sort of what do the scriptures say that how Jesus does things or what Jesus is like, and then looking at, well, how do these things fit together or not fit together? What's popular theology like? What is the God who Jesus seems to be serving, living out of, like? Okay, and some of the things. Well, we've been putting up a lot of different things. And then the interesting thing is that it usually puts us into some kind of a tension. It's not just that simple. At least it isn't for me. Maybe it is for you, and you just need to continue. Finish educating me today, if that's possible. But yesterday we were talking about, well, what does that mean for church? What is it to be church? And I thought we would just kind of continue with that. Holly and Sonia, if this... you know, if you're not kind of grabbing onto this in a few minutes, just give that puzzled look and we'll do more of a review. But we thought that it might be interesting to kind of start. Esther, you talked about your church yesterday. And just to kind of bring that up because, you know, just describe that a little bit. And I thought of that. Isn't that the church that everybody would want to be a part of?
It's a wonderful Lutheran congregation in the Central Valley in California, a little town called Visalia. And they've been very active in the community for many years. They do the hunger walk, and they do, they did a special thing, hands across Visalia. They had people for miles and miles with holding hands and bringing in canned foods and giving to the poor. And twice a year they go out to the labor camps and do things, and we work at the Hunger Kitchen that's sponsored by the Catholic Church, and it just goes on and on and on, and I've always been very proud of that, and so are the people. But yesterday when Bob was talking, it just kind of clicked that there are none of those people in the church, though. There are the white people who, some of them have a fair amount of money, some not quite so much, but there's nobody with darker skin, nobody with really, really poor clothes, and nobody with shabby shoes. And if one of us who dressing the way we dress at Holden for worship service would wander into the congregation, there might be a little tension. They would probably be, well, I think they would be fine, but people would still think, where's your respect? Where are your nice clothes?
So in terms, you said something clicked there where Bob was writing this study up.
I don't know what.
Okay. What was, I mean, just in terms of now, we'd kind of like this just to be a conversation that sort of continues from yesterday, and if it's not including those of you who have come for the first time today, we'll just back up and make sure it does. But what clicked for you in terms of what was coming up on the board and what pieces there, and then just we'll just add in and see where this goes, and the remember the title for today is what does it mean, the active life or activism, in light of sort of understanding God that Jesus is about. Okay, so keep going there.
Well, the thing, just some thoughts from yesterday. The thing also that has been really significant for me this week is when Bob has asked on every scripture, well, what did this person do to merit this healing or this statement, you are now saved? And I've always kind of thought, well, you know, the people who are hermits and the people who meditate and the people who fast and the people who pray all the time. Those are the ones. And yet, not according to the scriptures, it's just plain old people like us that somehow have an interaction with Jesus and then are different, are saved, or more whole.
One of the things that we put up on the board day after day would be looking through these scriptures in Matthew or something of Jesus having an encounter with someone, just like you were saying, Esther, and then looking at it from the perspective of the different characters, and sort of this popular theology where God is very judgmental, God is very distant, God is really kind of looking out and you know, going to check and see how you're doing with this kind of stuff. Pharisees in the scriptures or people would say, well, you shouldn't heal that person with a withered hand or that leper, or you shouldn't allow people to pick grain on Sundays because that's not the way God is. God has this order and this control. So that was kind of one list, and it looks pretty bleak, you know, here sitting from the side. Of course you should heal the guy with a withered hand, and which is exactly what Jesus does.
But not on the Sabbath.
Right. But the idea that these people were unclean and should be outside of the church anyway. And then looking at how does Jesus approach this? Jesus simply comes in compassion, and without the person having done anything, a lot of them were just sitting by the side of the road or whatever, Jesus heals that person, makes that well, you know, whatever sin is there is restored to wholeness. Okay? It looks like so good. But then we put up this list of, well, why would this popular theology be something that would be attracted to?
Or the dominant theology is another way to say it.
Dominant theology, yeah. I mean, why is it that that's attractive to us?
Does it provide some comfort, some safety, some barrier?
I know who my friends are, I know who my enemies are.
I know that, you know, I mean, taking the example that you've given of your church, well, we know that, you know, we're supposed to go out and be workers and help to heal. And so we do that. But we come back to church and we're safe there.
Right.
We, you know, where do we draw the line? You know, do we invite this person into our home? You know, that is sick, that has AIDS, that whatever the case may be. Do we go to the jail and say, give me a list of the people that, you know, just gotten out so I can give them a job, you know. No, you know, we don't do those things.
Right.
We isolate ourselves, and yes, we reach out in some way, some of us, others not. You know, everybody has their own.
We have a clearly us, them, you know, mentality, right? Even though we would all agree that we're all equally sinners, probably. If someone, the pastor said, all of us are at the foot of the cross is level, we're all equally sinners, people would say, oh yeah, that's true. But when it comes down to it, there's always an us, them, there's an us, them mentality.
And this helps us know who the them are.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Control. Yeah.
Is there a difference in theology and mentality that says go out and do good works as opposed to invite in?
Say a little more about that.
Well, I would just think Esther's church and what you seem to be saying is we go out into the world and we do these things. We go out to the prisons and say, I will be here with you there.
Yeah.
But it's a whole different mentality, and I think a whole different theology to say, come in and be part of us.
Yeah, definitely.
Or not even be part of us, sets up that dichotomy, but be here, at least with me.
It's a lot easier to control you or control the situation if I'm serving someone over there.
Because then you have the option of leaving.
Mm-hmm. Right. Plus, I'm doing what I'm supposed to do is love the other person. So I fulfill the commandment, right, by doing that. But it's without exposing myself or being exposed to the other person. Yeah.
But I think in the scriptures we have models of going out to bring in.
Oh, right? Definitely. I think we do.
We have both. We have both the going out and the bringing in. But going out alone, like there's so many groups that send young, like their youth groups down to Tijuana for a week or whatever to build housing. You know, I don't know if you guys Okay, that's a really common thing. But then, but a lot of those groups, they will not, they don't want to be involved directly in ministry to the migrant farm workers who are right, you know, right a mile down the road, right? Although more and more those people are wanting to be engaged, but to reach out to the poor that are right alongside you is always much harder than to go out a long ways away, right, on a mission project or something.
But you don't even have to get that radical with it. Yeah. Remember recently a scene in our own church where I was sitting by an elderly lady, and she watched the kids, some young people, I don't know what their ages were, maybe upward to about 16 or so. But you know, when they're in the room, the whole place kind of vibrates. They left and she went, "Phew. They're just so much, aren't they?"
Yeah, one of our questions is, how do we, you know, what is it that needs to take place so that these barriers, you know, maybe can be broken down? And what, and we talked earlier, like on the second day, about detoxing from theologies of glory, you know, in this, and we talked about how the recovery model is really appropriate for this, moving out of this theology of comfort and of, you know, where the rules are clear and where, you know, where God is a God of control and you know, where we know who we are and who they are, and, you know, where we're the insiders and the boundaries are established, to it, moving into this other way of following Jesus, this narrower way. And we talked about the recovery model, how in order to get into detox, you sort of have to bottom out, right? and then yesterday we talked briefly about how really one of the only ways to come to a place where the barriers are broken down is to find yourself as a fellow beggar in the ditch alongside the, you know, the street person that you want to minister to, right? Or, I mean, it's like we need to find ourselves, we need to come to a place of brokenness and of, and we need to bottom out ourselves and then on the other hand experience this Jesus's touch, you know, and we need to experience the grace of God so that we you know, we clearly are at a level of place, you know, a brother and sister with, you know, with the outsiders. So what is it, how can we come to that place? I mean, I don't want to turn this into an ethic like, you know, step 1, 2, 3 or a new 4 spiritual laws or something. It's not about that, but what needs to take place so that we can call a heroin addict our sister, brother, you know, or even a sex offender, you know, our neighbor.
I think it has something to do with looking at different models of service and how we view service as a place to start anyway, in that, I mean, first of all, there's levels that you go through. You know, you're making a face already. I'm not doing very well. people love to throw money at things. That's the first level of things, right? And maybe the next thing that you do is go down to Tijuana for a week, which, you know, certainly has its problems, but also its merits, because it's a good thing to get kids or people, you know, get their hands dirty or whatever in work. But I think that a third place that you look is coming to a place where you develop relationship with people, and I think that that's key. Mm-hmm. And also that all along in the steps, we're really good at talking about, you know, how great our church is because it does all these place things with service. You know, our church is constantly talking about how we're God's hands of service in the world without talking very much about the things that we gain from the service that we do. And once you start seeing the people that you're serving as people who are also gifting you, then it's easier to establish a relationship with them. And if that becomes a long-term thing, which would be the next level of service, and is doing kinds of service of you giving to what you have, from what you have to a group or a person over a long-term thing, then you're going to establish a relationship. And as you establish a relationship and understand the gifts that you're receiving from it, then you're more likely to come to a point where you'll grow enough to understand that this person should be a part of your community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sounds really good. So what keeps us from wanting to just go in that direction? I mean, that sounds really,
fear.
Really exciting.
It's fear.
And it's an abdication of control. When you throw money at something, you say, I want you to, the World Bank, I want you to spend the money on this, and I want you to spend it on this, and I want you to do these programs and this programs. So you're still in that hierarchy of control. You're the one on top. When you put yourself in a situation where you're the one being gifted, suddenly you surrender yourself to that gift.
Mm-hmm.
And people are unwilling to do that often.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think allows a person to move in that direction?
Well, it's a hope, you know, the hope of what we're going to gain from it. I heard some philosopher one time said that we never do anything for anyone else without expecting to gain something from it. And this maybe sounds crass, but in a sense it's true, because our hope is that we can attain discipleship and to have the blessings of that discipleship. And I think if we can adopt that idea of hope, you know, that not only the other person for whom we're doing something is going to benefit, but we also will benefit. It's a reciprocal thing. But again, I think you were right when you say we have to surrender ourselves to that. I think it's difficult to just say those four words, thy will be done, in my life. You know, I think they're really hard.
I think I operate that way a lot.
Yeah.
If you've got your scriptures, though, pull up to Matthew chapter 3. I just think there's a remarkable, we've used this before, but just to pull that open and kind of take a look at that. If you want to grab a few of those and pass them around, maybe not everybody has them. Matthew chapter 3, at the end of chapter 3. Remember, all during this week, we've been taking stories and we've been looking at, well, how does Jesus approach this? And now it's there at verse 16 in chapter 3. And kind of thinking about this as the dominant theology versus this sort of way that Jesus understands God. When Jesus had been baptized, just as he came up from the water, suddenly the heavens were opened to him, and he saw the Spirit of God descending like a dove and alighting on him. And a voice from heaven said, "This is my Son, the Beloved, with whom I am well pleased." You know, certainly the appropriate time for Jesus to say, "Hey, well, clearly I'm getting my reciprocal goods, huh?" And then immediately, at least in the Gospel of Mark, it says the word immediately. Here it says, then, as we continue, Jesus was led up by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. He fasted 40 days and 40 nights, and afterwards he was famished. This piece of the scripture for me, it just knocks me out when I read it, because the sense, you know, that if I do this, then I should get some blessing. I will get some blessing. I mean, it's clearly there in me. That I want to get a result for what I do. And so much of my world works that way. That's the way it worked in high school for me, with my grades. So much of my world works that way. But where does that put us in terms of the theologies that we've been working with all week? Well, then I have some control. My input is going to give this blessing. And you know, for me, it's really subtle because it keeps grabbing me, and because so much of the world works that way. You know, I know that campus ministry this year, in some sense, dependent on what I do, certain things are going to happen. Okay, and then I can come to understand, if I just project that, well, that's the way God works. If I do this, God will bless me. But continue there, you know, Jesus was led up by the Spirit, so what ought to be this great blessing turns immediately into the wilderness.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it that, you know, it's like, boom, you just won the lottery. And what happens? You know, then you're just sent out to hell.
Yeah.
And then I think the real interesting piece is,
okay, so then what? You know, after that, then what? Do I just give up? Do I just say, well, I should try harder because then God will bless me again and I'll get baptized again when I've gotten it right? I think, you know, I think if you look at this and just start looking, well, what does Jesus do out of this? I think the only thing that makes sense for this guy is to, well, when there's a guy with a withered hand on the Sabbath on the street, that person is no different than me, you know? I've been baptized, I've been cursed in the wilderness. We're brothers, we're sisters. What does it mean to say to you, the kingdom of God is here with you now? Not because it's going to get him anything. I mean, he could just as likely get baptized as thrown into the wilderness. It's an incredible picture of Jesus that comes up here now based on these things.
You know, and it ties in very well with this Colossians text. You know, so if you've been raised with Christ, seek the things that are above where Christ is, seated at the right hand of God. Set your minds on things that are above, not on things that are on earth, for you have died. I mean, you know, that's baptism, right? Baptism is a death. You know, of course, we're raised up as well, which that's mentioned as well, but the death part is, I think, the first step in detoxing, right? We have to bottom out. We need to come to the place of brokenness. And how is that going to happen? You know, in the Gospels, we have many models for how it happens. I mean, Jesus is led by the Holy Spirit from this baptismal death into a place of temptation. Okay, well, the Apostle Paul, he's met by Jesus on the road to Damascus, and he's confronted by the fact that by something so much greater than his merit system that he was very successful at achieving. He was brought to a place of crisis, okay, and that was a death for him, a blindness and everything until he was, you know, restored and his conversion. That was a conversion of a Pharisee, right? Then you have the conversion of folks that are already down. I mean, you know, the blind, the lepers who Jesus touches. You know, maybe people who, because of some calamity, they ended up in the gutter. Okay, so there's many ways that we can come to a place of brokenness. It could be through a direct encounter. It could be through some crisis, some circumstance in our life. But death appears to me to be a major part of the picture. You know, as a context out of which we can begin to hear the word. You know, you are my beloved son. You know, I mean, one of the problems with the dominant theology is we're presented with these morals. I mean, this what Christian life looks like. You're loving the poor, you know, giving yourself, you know, to the outcast or whatever, the marginalized, serving. You know, we all know we can make a huge list of all, and the lists vary depending on the denomination, right? But I think this approach is something much deeper. It's about learning to discern the voice from out of death. You know, it's like Genesis 1. In the beginning, when God was creating the heavens and the earth was formless and void, and darkness was over the face of the deep. That's death, right? And then God said, Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the deep. Then God said, let there be light. Okay? And there was light. It's like that voice, you are my beloved, or let there be light. That the authentic, the real voice, that we've got to somehow get to the point where we're in tune with that voice, you know, rather than with some external moral system or doctrinal position or confession, which is not rooted in our guts, you know, in our deepest self.
One of the things for me, and talked with Bob about this too, and a lot of other people, is I really can't tell this to anybody. You know, if I don't want to die, I don't want to die. And I don't want to die. Generally, something has happened to me. I mean, for me, it was in college. Just sort of nothing made sense anymore. I did great in high school. I did great in college, blah, 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 you know. I achieved those things. My sense was, see, and this verse can be read both ways, and there's no telling a person to do one or the other. Which way do you read it, Esther?
Well, I'm trying to read it the new way. But as he was reading it, I thought, well, yeah, sure.
Seek the things that are above.
Right.
I have applied my heart to the things that are above. You know, and God will bless me for that, or God should bless me, or if God doesn't, God is not just, but that's the way God ought to operate, so God was sleeping on the job or something. You know, we get so into that, right? I mean, Esther, you said, I've been so trained in that mode that I can't see them any other way. Seek the things that are above. That's the dominant theology. Stay right there. You know, where Christ is seated at the right hand of God. Who's God then? Well, dominant theology says this is a judge. Set your mind on things that are above, not on things that are on earth, right?
So now I need to stop watching movies and give up television and some of the books that I like to read. And I mean, this is the kind of stuff that goes through my mind.
Right.
If I've got to do that, then I've got to do this. And
there's no telling you. Well, there's telling a person, but there's no making a person see this differently. I mean, as we've talked, the only reason that you're trying to see this differently is because that way no longer works.
Well, and I kind of had a crisis like you and he both talked about.
Right.
Yeah.
So the gospel in here is, for you have died. You know, and I recognize in that, you know, when I couldn't get back in the church after I was divorced, you said, right? I mean, there's a death that goes on there. The world doesn't work this way anymore for me. And then you've got a choice. You can say, well, I'll just make it work this way anyway. You know, I'll just keep making it work this way. Somehow I'm going to try hard enough to make it work that way.
I get into trouble with it. Because now a lot of the things that I was taught to respect, such as certain kinds of authority, appear so ludicrous to me. The silly games the politicians play is just some junk, some games they play in my mind, because my president or great leader is not of this world.
Do you hear that same story in the scriptures? Now you approach the man with the withered hand.
Yeah.
And the authority says, don't do this on the Sabbath. And make sure this person is clean enough and right enough before you can be present with this person. I mean, that's this, you know? And there's no saying, well, go out and die then today so that you'll understand. It comes along in life, or maybe it doesn't come along in life, but unless it comes along in life, I think we just keep reading this way. I guess I feel like as a pastor, my job is just wait around for the dead people.
Yeah.
Seriously.
But see, it can happen that other way, though. If you are seeking, seeking, seeking. I mean, that's the Apostle Paul's way, right? That's Martin Luther's way. He was seeking, 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 and he got to the point where the more he sought after God, the more he recognized that he was just he was dust and ashes. I mean, he was a sinner, right? He came to the point of just burning himself out on works righteousness, right? And it was out of that death that came the conversion. That is one way that God brings about people's conversion, is through, you know, allowing them to go along that path of in the dominant theology.
Is it wrong then? Do you suggest that we should not see, you know, those who are in the beginning stages of wanting a different way of thinking? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
To be a seeker is not wrong, is it?
No.
I mean, because ultimately, at least you're on the right road.
Oh, it's all about seeking. I think it's all about seeking. But I think what I'm talking about seeking is like having, I don't know, how would you describe it? It's like seeing that as a rule, a rule of life. Okay, we have to seek. You know, we have to seek the things that are above, and we already know kind of what those things might be. It means keeping yourself morally pure in these ways, and you know, in doing these actions, you know, maybe a devotional life. I mean, I grew up being pushed to have my quiet time, so I got pushed so much in that direction, you know, I mean, encouraged, but overly, you know, and by overly zealous people, that I just got to the point where, I mean, I was failing at having my quiet time for so long that I finally just thought I must be damned. I mean, I can't do it, you know. So, I mean, that's what I mean by seeking. Being pushed to seek as something that is an external word that is being pushed on you by someone that has an agenda about what it means to be a Christian, right? Rather than hearing, having the seeking come from the deepest part of who you are. You know?
Well, that's the difference between extrinsic and that intrinsic motivation.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
In a learning environment, what you want to do is hopefully inspire some intrinsic motivation, because then the person from inside seeks, you know, whatever being offered.
Yeah, second more on this one. You know, Esther, you talked to me, and it's like, this is the way I was raised. The seeking the things that are above in terms of the rules, okay? And then there comes a point at which I'm no longer within the boundaries of the rules. You know, it's not working for me. Something's happened in my life, external or internal, but it's not working anymore. And then you said, well, I just kept trying. I just kept trying this way. But then you said there came this point where I just put the scriptures down and I left the church, okay? So we can keep going in this route for a long time after it quits working for us, because it's the only thing we know. And then there can come this wilderness time that may go for a long time, you know, where no word comes, no new way or anything like that. And then sometime maybe some language comes or some voice comes or something comes that says, you know, this is exactly what who Jesus is God is interested in, me in this place, not because I came from this place. Right.
Wouldn't that way, in a lot of ways, be the way that we gain brotherhood and sisterhood with the leper? Because you go through that and you seek and you seek, and suddenly you realize that everyone is an outcast, because no one can fulfill that.
Yes.
And so through that, you gain that brotherhood and sisterhood.
So one more verse. For all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. Is that a rules one, Esther?
Sure.
It's rules. But sin. What about sin as broken relationship instead of broken rule? Sin is not about broken rules. Sin is about broken relationships. For all are outcast. And therefore, I too am outcast. I too am broken in my relationship with God. And so God, who is for me now in my understanding, is also for the leper. It's also for everyone else in exactly the same regard. You see how these verses, I mean, we can read them that way, and there's no telling you 20 years ago that that wasn't rules. We could have sat here 20 years ago and you would have just, now I know this. And then at some point, it's okay to flip that over, because I'm desperate for that word that says, God is still for me and for everyone else.
You know, for me, when I look at Jesus, and you know, he comes out of this, he's in the desert, and in this, he's experiencing this incredible temptation. That the temptation, what that consists of, is hearing other voices, okay, and being tempted to go with other voices, right? And I think the question of vocation is really at the heart of a new way of looking at activism, okay? And what I mean by vocation is hearing the voice, okay, the authentic voice, and being able to distinguish that authentic voice from the voices of the tempter, you know, the evil one who presents himself or herself as a, you know, as the righteous way, the narrow way or whatever, you know, bow down to me and I will give you all the kingdoms of the earth, or you know, you're hungry, hey, turn that bread into stone, I mean the stone into bread, look, well, you know, you're capable of doing that. I mean, there are these voices that represent the theology of glory, you know, that Jesus is presented with. You know, throw yourself down from the temple. You know, of course, everyone will believe in you if the angels, if they see the angels escorting you down and setting you down in front of the temple, completely cuffed fine, you know, delivered. I mean, you know, all these different voices. We're bombarded by all kinds of voices that are external voices that are voices of the false Christ, you know. And I believe that for me the whole question is trying to, in terms of developing an authentic activism, authentic spirituality, it's a matter of learning how to wait, you know. And Lamentations chapter 3 is a place that I continually go back to. You're probably familiar with it. Verse 16, it says, or even further, 13 or earlier, he shot into my vitals the arrow of his quiver. I have become a laughingstock of all the people, the object of their taunt songs all day long. He's filled me with bitterness. He has sated me with wormwood. He's made my teeth grind on gravel and made me cower in ashes. My soul is bereft of peace. I have forgotten what happiness is. So I say, gone is my glory and all that I have hoped for from the Lord. The thought of my affliction and my homelessness is wormwood and gall. My soul continually thinks of it and is bowed down within me. But this I call to mind, and therefore I have hope. The steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. His mercies never come to an end. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. The Lord is my portion, says my soul. Therefore I will hope in him. The Lord is good to those who wait for him, to the soul that seeks him. It is good that one should wait quietly for the salvation of the Lord. It is good for one to bear the yoke in youth, to sit alone in silence when the Lord has imposed it, to put one's mouth to the dust. There may yet be hope, okay? To give one's cheek to the smiter and to be filled with insults. For the Lord will not reject forever. Although he causes grief, he will have compassion according to the abundance of his steadfast love. You want me to let ourselves be in a place where we're facing our pain and our own feelings of being excluded, our own deeper suffering, you know, and then to cry out and to wait, you know, and to not be satisfied for anything but the authentic word, you know, that raises us up.
So salvation isn't something that we do for ourselves. It's something that we wait for according to Lamentations.
Yeah. And it's something we watch for. I mean, there's other models of, like, the sentinel that is watching and, you know, waiting for the word. Here, this is the idea of waiting, okay? We're waiting. We're not going to accept anything but the authentic word, okay? And I'm going to put my face in the dust. I mean, I love this model of the Roman Catholic priests or Episcopal priests when they're consecrated. You know, they lay on the face down on the ground. Sometimes I wish they'd stay there, though. You know, because being raised up is you know, that to hear the word and to be raised up to a place of openness and attentiveness and watchfulness. You know, to watch for the and to listen for the way. I mean, it's a spirituality that I'm talking about here, I think, but it also is a spirituality that leads to, you know, to an activism. You know, when Jesus is later on in Matthew's Gospel, in chapter 4, when he's right after the temptation, he goes up to Galilee, and he's immediately described as just going out and preaching the good news and healing the sick and everybody, everything. And then the next step, okay, he goes by the Sea of Galilee, and he sees these fishermen, and he calls them by their name. You know, he calls them, "Follow me," okay. What's interesting, he doesn't give them an agenda. He doesn't tell them what they should leave either. He doesn't say, "Leave your nets." He doesn't say, "Follow me and you'll and do this, this, and this. This is my program." What all he says is, "Follow me," and then he says, "And I will make you become fishers of people." Okay, all I'm calling you to do is hear my voice, right? You know, to follow me, and it's my responsibility. I will make you become fishers of people. So I hear that as being very consistent with this, you know, this idea of Lamentations. You know, from wherever we are, to just await that word and try to be faithful to that call. That's a different way than this way of glory where we kind of know it's all mapped out and it's programmed for us.
To come back to seeking, at least in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, in the Gospel, seeking is a very dangerous word, and precisely because it can be good news, or very often, as Lars was pointing out through Esther, it's the rules, and that 90% of the time the word seek in Matthew, Mark, and Luke is always used for Jesus' enemies. For example, two examples. In Matthew, when the wise men come into Jerusalem, thinking naturally that's where the king of the Jews would be, and they end up seeing Herod says to them, seek diligently for the child, that I too may come and worship him. Or in Mark, the confrontation after healing the man with the withered hand, then the authorities begin to seek how they might destroy him. And then in the end, in Mark's gospel, the resurrection narrative, this man clothed in white at the tomb says to the women, "Why do you seek the living among the dead? He's not here." You know, you keep seeking in that rule-bound way. You know, don't think you're going to find Jesus. You'll never find Jesus with that kind of seeking. Where is he? And then that sense again, remember what he told you. And that takes us back into the whole gospel. And what we have to ask ourselves again is, well, what did Jesus say? And then we're right back to what you've been putting in front of us again, whether that's in Matthew 3 and 4 and the withered hand or all over the place. You find out that what Jesus is saying is something very different from what you think we have to be seeking. So seeking is very dangerous. It's a very dangerous word. You have to be careful with it.
So the fact that it's above tends to indicate that it's beyond what seems to be normally evident to be. Do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think if we look at a passage like this about seek the things that are above, you have to also, you know, look at what happens thereafter, for you have died. What you're looking for, it's already been given to you, right? Christ, who is your, when Christ, who is your life, is revealed. It's again that sense of seeking what's always already there in front of you.
But one of my problems, like if I think about how I often begin my day, I wake up and I have my breakfast, whatever, I go up in my office sometimes, and sometimes there's an anxiety that I experience where, okay, there's so much I could do and so much that I maybe need to do, and I'm tempted to kind of grab the phone and start advocating for somebody who I know is in trouble or whatever, and sometimes I'll just go on a run where I'm just kind of working out of anxiety, I'm just busy, you know, doing all the things that I kind of feel like I should do. But more and more I've been just saying, stop. You know, just stop. Slow down, you know. Find some peace, okay? Start and just get, you know, mellow out, you know, relax. Open, you know, I'm trying consciously to just stop myself from that, you know, that way of just kind of responding to the to needs as something that are external to me, rather than being, you know, being in touch with my, you know, with the deep, with something deeper, right? Working out of a place of peace and also a place of attentiveness to whatever might happen, might come, you know, walking in a more existential way. And oftentimes when I do that, when I just stop myself, and I have to do this over and over throughout the day, because I can be driven and I have a workaholic tendency, and you know, clearly I see that in myself. But when I just stop myself and I see that, and I just say, okay, when I await the word or whatever, and I just open myself to whatever might happen, whatever might come my way. Sometimes I'm just completely surprised. You know, something comes into my day which completely is unexpected, you know, which leads me in a completely unexpected direction. You know, which turns out to be sometimes very fruitful, you know, and very satisfying, you know, but I'm constantly having to resist the voices of obligation, the voices of that are coming out of my anxiety, out of my need to be productive, all these other voices, right? And that's, and part of my problem with the scriptures too, and what I passed out to you is tremendously dangerous, but I wanted to help interpret it a bit for you. But part of my problem with the scriptures is that if that becomes an external system that where we're looking for information about sort of what the Christian life looks like and what Jesus did, we can easily fall into this other way, right? Yeah. But see, this thing I passed out is does exactly what Michael was suggesting. When we look, at least the way I understood what you said, Michael. You know, when Jesus called the disciples, he called them, he says, follow me and I will make you become fishers of people. Well, one of the questions is, how do we follow Jesus? And how are the scriptures a resource for us in understanding what it means to follow Jesus? I don't know that I don't think I have the final word on this at all at this point, but it's something I'm struggling with on a regular basis, right? But when I look at, if I'm looking at following Jesus, one of the ways that I can follow Jesus is looking, is actually following him through the Gospels. You know, looking at Jesus' movements and actions and, you know, this whole question on the back of where Jesus was and what Jesus did on behalf of who, in front of who, with what results are, you know, is a fascinating question. And when I do that, what I find is an incredible diversity of actions. You know, it's like a different action, a different verb is used for, there's a wide range of verbs that are used for, with Jesus as subject. You know, I mean, if you look at Matthew 4, 23-25. Could someone read that?
At the bottom of page 1 there?
Bottom of page 1, yeah. Don't bother reading this first part yet. Read that later.
Jesus went throughout Galilee, teaching in the synagogues and proclaiming the good news of the kingdom and curing every disease and every sickness among the people. So his fame spread throughout all Syria, and they brought to him all the sick, those who were afflicted with various diseases and pains, demoniacs, epileptics, and paralytics, and cured them. And great crowds followed him.
Why don't you read the next one, too?
That evening they brought to him many who were possessed with demons, and he cast out the spirits with a word and cured all who were sick. Then Jesus went about all the cities and villages, teaching in their synagogues and proclaiming the good news of the kingdom and curing every disease and every sickness. When he saw the crowds, he had compassion for them because they were harassed and helpless, like sheep without a shepherd.
So here we get a glimpse of what, of the direction that Jesus went himself, right? And one of the questions is, and when we look at our own ways of doing ministry, I mean, I think we need to let ourselves be challenged by this in a way, but avoiding the pitfall of turning this into a new moralism, right? Where we just say, okay, Jesus did that, so here I go, right? And going out and being driven to kind of copy Jesus as moral hero.
WWJD, remember? What would you do?
Yeah. So you know, we have this external word about what Jesus did, but on the other hand, we have this original word, which was, follow me, and I will make you become fishers of people. How can we put these two together? How do you see this?
Is that an individual thing that we need to prayerfully concern as an individual? I mean, do we do all of these things as an individual? Do we teach? Do we cure? Or are we each called to do something or some group of things?
Yeah. Well, and how would you discern whether you were what you were to do? How would you know that, how to answer that question for yourself?
You know, back in college, you know, I was failing organic chem and somehow I passed, you know, I took that as a sign, you know, I I don't know.
That's the dentist.
Yeah.
I'm definitely going to you.
Please, God. No patient has ever asked me whether my grade was organic chemistry. If, you know, please, God, if you get me through this, you know, yeah. I'll do good things, you know, I promise. But it's more than that on a day-to-day basis, you know. I mean, sometimes it's like, I think we're going this way, and God throws his right hand turn. That certainly happened when we ended up going to Alaska, the last thing in the world, you know, the place that I thought I would ever end up. And it was the right place for us to be for a while. I don't know, I'm still...
still very much seeking and wondering, you know, okay, now here we are going down a path, you know, is that the right path? Is that, you know, where we're supposed to be? And life changes.
And but you see what I mean by that question, though? I mean, if Jesus calls the disciples and says, follow me, I mean, first of all, I want to wait until I hear that call myself, follow me, right? You know, maybe that's a call I need to hear every day. But then on the other hand, we have these words about what Jesus did, okay? Which, you know, we can say, okay, well, okay, following Jesus, well, he's not here anymore, so here's what he did, let's do this, you know, bang, 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 1, 2, 3, 4, this is my agenda. Okay, well, but we have the original word, follow me. You know, it's a singular imperative. There's only one imperative, follow me.
But how do you know when you're following him, or as you pointed out, that there are these other voices, you know, the tempting in the wilderness that aren't, at least to me, so clearly, is that a temptation, or is that something I'm being called to do?
That's a good question. How do you know?
How do you know?
Mm-hmm. I can't think of it exactly, it's somewhere in there, because Jesus talks about when you see a tree is budding, you know that the summer is near. And the other signs that, for example, a farmer, when you see signs in nature, you know it has certain meanings. And talking about reading the signs of the times, and we know how to do these things, we sort of know how to interpret things on a sort of a basic level every day. And in some ways, I think he seems to be saying, it's very simple. We don't have to make it that complicated. But there is that kind of freedom to interpret, okay, what is, in this situation in which I find myself, what is the loving course of action?
Yeah.
And I think we're given great freedom as Christians to be creative and imaginative, and I think Holden's very good at being creative and imaginative. And that's not part of what do I have to do, but what am I, you know, as part of who I am, out of my mouth, and how am I free to do in a situation? Part of a Bible study that I do every week with university students, we first talk about what's going on in the world and what's our context, what are the needs, and what's going on in our own lives. And then we read the gospel reflection, and then we try to put them in conversation, and we sort of ask something like this, a text like this, you might say, you know, who are the people in your own life that you know who are called to be a healing presence to? Something could be very simple like that.
Mm-hmm.
Just sort of make us aware.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a service question of being called to, not whether you have.
Yeah, but see, that calling, discerning that calling, is not always evident. Or discerning God. I mean, you know, my son Isaac.
That's why it's helpful to have a group of people. And that's what I would say, is that you sit around in a group, and somebody can see something that somebody else can't see, and something in my experience somebody else might have an insight. I mean, this seems to relate to this. And what about?
But there's a danger in that, too. I mean, that's Presbyterianism, in a way. The committee, you know, getting it. No, I mean, I'm not saying that your model is exactly what Presbyterianism is, but that's, you know, the Presbyterian Church is the church of the elders, the body that gets together, and as a committee, you know, it's all a committee structure, right? As the committees decide, okay, what's the course of action, and the church is led by these committees. I mean, and that works. That is one way, one model, where God's will is revealed, but it's only one model. You know, in this case, Jesus went and called these people as individuals, right? And there wasn't they didn't sit around as a committee and say, okay, well, you know, do we know who this guy is? And is this an authentic call? And we don't know that anyway. It just says immediately they left their nets and they followed him, right? You know, so I guess I'm agreeing with you completely about the value of a community. But on the other hand, it's like that the community sometimes could take the place of my own of just being a singular individual before God and hearing the word and or not hearing the word.
Right. When every voice in the community is heard, I think you have a better chance of hearing the scriptures speak, rather than maybe having a certain group within it to be able to say we have the truth.
So maybe the people in the street, the people in the homeless shelter, including is part of the community too, right?
Mm-hmm.
Not just my.
This one woman speaker said that it takes the whole community to speak the truth, including people from the margins especially.
I'd like to piggyback on that by saying that it's important, I think, and has been helpful to me to recognize, number one, the gifts I have and don't have, because I could, you know, probably insert myself into a number of different capacities in a church, but I don't think I'd be very good at some of them. So I'd rather not do that. And then to recognize that, the second thing is to recognize that each person probably feels that way in a varying degree of having developed his or her worldview and readiness and commitment level to this. And maybe some of us have heard the voice, if you will, the voice, and some have not, but are still seekers and at varying, you know, intensities. And that's okay if we have tolerance for that growth and you know what I'm saying about
yeah.
that?
Although
we're
I think,
not all at the same, we're not on all on the X yet.
Although I think the gifts, I mean, while I agree that it is important to try to discern what your gifts are, I've seen many churches do these spiritual gift inventories, which make it very comfortable for people sometimes to just decide to not go in certain directions. And,
and
with this theology, you know, if I look at 1 Corinthians chapter 1 that describes the weakness of the community, you know, I mean, sometimes I've gone in directions. I mean, a lot of my ministry is doing things now that I never felt like I was gifted at. I thought the last thing I could ever do would be a chaplain of a jail.
Mm-hmm.
You know, until the day that I started working there practically. I mean, I resisted that with my whole being. I just thought, no way. That is one thing that I know that is not for me, is to work with inmates. You know, I'll be manipulated, taken advantage of, and all these things. And I just hear so many people in the churches saying, well, I don't feel gifted in these areas. And so they stay in their comfort zone. You know, whereas here, there's not, Jesus is calling them to do one thing. There's one imperative here. Follow me. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Follow me, and I will make you become. You know, Jesus takes the responsibility for making us become fishers of people in whatever way that means. You know what I mean?
And I certainly understand your point of view. What I was getting at is something a little bit more pragmatic in that. My husband's an accountant. Don't put me in charge of the book. In the church.
Yeah, right.
But I mean, I would never feel as though I could make as good a contribution in that particular way. My gifts are not there, but his are. So put him in charge of the book.
At the same, oh, go ahead, Brian.
I was just going to say, I'm a poet. Don't put me in charge of the computers.
Yeah.
But that's my job. And I've done it.
Get a smaller group, you may end up with a job.
And I've been challenged, and I've learned beautiful things through that. And I'm certainly not called to go work in computers elsewhere, but that was the need.
And I do take risks, too. I mean, I'll get into something I really don't know for sure if I can do. But they're calculated now that I'm older, because I have lived long enough to know some of my, you know, things that I don't do well. And I'm not trying to use that as a cop-out, but I know what you're saying about, you know, people trying to excuse themselves by staying in a comfort area. But what I'm saying is that sometimes those of us who have kicked around a little longer know that I really wouldn't do a good job of that, but there will be something else that can do better.
You know, one of, oh, go ahead, Michael.
I would think, I mean, yes, Jesus calls, Jesus sends, but along with that is always, I think, as some of us have been talking, it's always the call of the other. That's there, and we see that too, that, you know, again, for example, in Mark's gospel, as Jesus is on the way, right, and he's on the way to do something, particularly like on the way to Jerusalem to suffer and die, while on the way, a voice would cry out, Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me. Now, there could be an option. Jesus could say, well, I'm sorry, you see, I'm called and I'm on a mission and I've got to go to Jerusalem and suffer and die for everybody. So, you know, I'm sorry, no mercy for you. Or you say, here's the call. Right now, this is the voice calling out that as God has sent me into the world, here is where I serve. The parable of the Good Samaritan is, again, that kind of understanding. Or Luther in his earthly way, when he has his commentary on the Sermon on the Mount, he has a place where he says to the person, you know, your workshop, your tools, even your beer barrel cries out, serve and love the neighbor. I mean, I think it's all those ways in which the call comes about. Wherever you happen to be, listen to those voices around you, because that's where God is calling you to be.
Did you say
fear,
Bill?
Yes.
Amen. Amen.
Oh. I'm just quoting Luther.
But let's take the flip side of that. I mean, isn't that absolutely ludicrous? Absolutely ludicrous. I was in seminary and I heard a sermon on, it was one of the stories about sick people that Jesus healed, you know. So the sermon priest was, what if I'd met one on the way? I wouldn't be here to preach this sermon. Right? But what should I do? Should I pass that person by so that I can meet my obligation to preach that sermon? I mean, that's kind of a trivial example, but then we had an earthquake in San Francisco when I was there, and one of the professors says, well, the appropriate thing for us to do is study the Word of God. And another student said, hell no. And we were down, he got organized 20 students to go down and bring soup to the Red Cross workers who were digging people out from underneath the freeway.
Yeah.
But, you know, this dominant theology, right? One of the big words in there is control. Insiders and outsiders. One of the dominant words in this theology of how, or just the way that Jesus does things, is no control. That's what you were saying, yeah. Michael. And, you know, in terms of action in the world, you know, what do you do? I mean, do I go home tonight and say, what's practical? Or what's faithful? Or do practicality and faithfulness go together? These for me are the really deep questions. Because why should I ask, you know, what if I feel called to do this and I go home and tell Ann and the kids, this is what I feel called to do, boom, and we're off. You know? What
if
she feels, or Ann feels called to do something? Those are the hard questions.
You know,
for me, it makes total sense, this dominant theology. It makes total sense, and it makes total sense of how absolutely difficult it is to get out of it. Because what? I have to be accountable to my children, my family, my job, the people I work with. You know, to get out of that and say, well, you know, not even have a cell phone, just not show up that day. Because something came that in which compassion was needed in that moment. And I've got people back at church who are upset that I come out to Holden Village. Why? Because I'm not under the thumb. I'm not under control. This isn't your job to come out here. Your job is back here, where you're by the phone and where you can, you know, seriously, when I go back, I'll have to deal with that.
Let me tell you a story that may help you with it. You can use the story about the mother who used to go into the kitchen every single day between a certain hour and a certain hour. She'd have 1 hour to herself in that kitchen. She'd shut the door and her children would be out there playing. So one day her children at the door clamoring and they're knocking and knocking. And what's she doing? She makes a pot of tea and she drinks the whole pot very slowly. So while the children are clamoring at the door, Mommy, Mommy, what are you doing in there? She says, I'm in here making you a better mommy. And that's what you're doing here at Holden.
Yeah, definitely. You know, can we read these next verses about Jesus' summoning of the 12 before we have to go to dinner? Could someone read for us the first one that says, when Jesus sends out his disciples, similar verbs are used to describe their ministry. Then there's two verses, 10:1 and 10:5-8.
Then Jesus summoned his 12 disciples and gave them authority over unclean spirits to cast them out and to cure every disease and every sickness. These 12 Jesus sent out with the following instructions. Go nowhere among the Gentiles and enter no town of the Samaritans, but go rather to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. As you go, proclaim the good news. The kingdom of heaven has come near. Cure the sick, raise the dead, cleanse the lepers, cast out demons.
Now, if Jesus came and just was right here right now and just said, okay, I'm giving you authority, go out, and he gave us these words, how would we feel?
Who would be the Samaritan?
Well, I know, we'd have to look at equivalence and you know, and think about what that might mean, and we have to look about, think about, okay, Galilee, we have to go to Israel, or is there kind of an equivalent of Galilee, or, you know, and lepers, okay, well, there aren't any lepers, well, what might a modern equivalent of a leper be, and demon-possessed, well, what does that mean, is that people that are in, that are no longer in our psycho wards, that have been closed down, that are on the street, homeless folks, or, you know, that's the difficult work of interpreting this stuff for today, right? But how would you feel? Like, how would you feel if this was a word addressed to you?
Completely unequipped.
Yeah.
Scared.
Yeah. Raise the dead.
Okay.
Sure. Hey, we're
sure.
No,
Jesus.
I don't believe that Jesus is thinking the way we think in terms of our expertise. You know, choosing people that have an expertise in all these areas. I mean, you know, our typical way of doing missions is to hire people for specific jobs and hire well-qualified people who are well-trained. You know, a doctor for a medical mission. Well, that's probably a good idea. One of our experiences, Gracie and I, we went to Honduras. We went to Honduras and we were just like, okay, we want to work for the poor in some way. We don't know how. We had a job possibility of working with refugees fleeing from El Salvador, and that ended up falling through because our contact was found murdered. Anyway, we ended up meeting this Honduran Development Agency guy who said, "You want to help the poor? Don't go to the border. Look, we need you in a village right here in Honduras. If you want to help the poor, forget about health work. Look, you have to teach agriculture." You know, and Gracie and I were like, agriculture? You know, we grew up in the suburbs, you know. We know how to spread beauty bark around rhododendrons and mowing lawns and stuff. Well, agriculture? And he says, "No problem, you know, I'll find you a Honduran peasant who's a master at organic intensive agriculture. He can teach you." Okay, well, a light went off in our head. We heard about learning from the poor, right? We thought we were idealistic enough to think, that's great. So anyway, we went out, and I'd never hardly planted a seed in my life, you know. And we went and started this demonstration farm. But our teacher was Fernando, who had a third grade education, a 55-year-old peasant, who looked at us and said, "I don't know anything. You guys are the experts." And we'd have to say, "Fernando, we don't know anything." You know, and finally, when we practically destroyed his machete on the rocks because we didn't know how to use it, you know, and it became evident to him that we didn't know anything. He started to, we were able to convince him to teach us something. But see, the roles were reversed, you know, and we learned from this man. And we didn't know anything about peasant culture, how to ride a horse. You know, we had to buy horses and a mule, and people came by to have us test drive their mules. You know, first time I got on, my glasses practically knocked my nose off, you know. It was just jolted to the core. I didn't know how to ride at all. You know, and I couldn't get Fernando to ride the horses to test drive them or anything, to find out which one we should get. You know, and we were in a difficult position of being seen as the experts, but having to convince the real expert that he needed to be our teacher. Okay? And that was not our gift, okay, agriculture. And it still is not my gift. But suddenly we found ourselves in a place where we were tremendously weak. But it was that weakness that allowed our ministry to really flourish, you know, because we had to learn from the people. We were placed in a position where they were our teachers.
And what a wonderful position to be in, when all of a sudden it gives you some freedom, doesn't it, to say, okay, I don't know nothing, but I have to do this. There's nobody else.
I think that this call of Jesus is a crazy call. And I think that's why it is resisted. Because it is a call to go out and to just say, okay, well, what does this mean? Cleansing lepers? You know, casting out demons? You know, I'm not gifted at that. I'm not a psychologist. I'm not a doctor. I'm not a, you know, what am I, you know? We're placed in freedom, okay, like you mentioned. But it's a scary freedom. And that's why we run to the institution and we say, okay, train me and send me out in a way that I can actually, where I have a job description and everything set. And we fall into the institutional way of doing things and into the dominant theology.
I don't think we should throw the baby out with the bathwater. I mean, there's a place for, you know, skilled work, of course.
Definitely.
What I'm saying is maybe be open to doing something that you didn't expect to do and be open to being used.
And be open to the voice, okay? You know, when that guy said, you go, you teach agriculture, I mean, I heard that. I was so excited. I was scared, but I was excited, you know, and it was the voice of God. I know it was for me at that moment, you know, and I thank God that it was incredible that we even got into that guy's office in the first place. And, you know, that was our ministry. We've been doing it for 18, almost 20 years now. And Tierra Nueva, that was the founding of, and now we're still, now it's Tierra Nueva del Norte, our ministry now. And that's been our life for the last 20 years. And who would have ever known? And anyway, but to discern the voice, the authentic voice, okay?
It seems to me when you're open to that kind of a call, even as you go on doing your skilled thing, whatever it is, or maybe you aren't, but when you're open to those, looking at those people on the roadside who are put before you, when you're open to it, you're given the skills that you need, which is so scriptural as well. I mean, that Jesus says, and I will go with you, and says to Moses, God says to Moses, you know, I'll give you the right words to say, and it's later on that you discover, I mean, that if you end up at the bedside of someone who's dying for your first time, for instance, not having any idea what to say, and you're pretty sure you have no clue that you'll ever know what to say, and find out later on that what you said or didn't say was exactly what needed to be done at that time. It's so clearly what God has given you and not something that you've done for yourself. That's just one of those things that you need to learn, is that you're given what you need in that situation.
And you don't know what you're supposed to leave behind either. You know, a lot of guys ask me in the jail, do I have to stop smoking pot? Do I have to start, you know, do you think I can follow Jesus and you know, I really like getting high. I mean, you know, I really like it. Do I have to stop getting high? And I say, oh, no, you don't have to stop getting high. I mean, you know, you just follow Jesus. And if it'll become evident to you, you'll know if you're seeking after, Jesus and you're listening to the voice, try to hear that voice, okay? And make sure that it's the right voice that's telling you, yeah, you know, you don't need pot anymore. But don't drop it. Don't drop it unless you hear that voice. That's what I tell people. And they're just shocked. You know, cocaine, oh man, why you stop that? It's helping you. Make sure that you know that you're in touch with the deeper voice. You know, otherwise it's the morality, it's the system, that is the external system, it's the dominant theology that they're responding to instead of to the deeper, you know, follow me.
You know, it's the difference between seeking and being revealed. The difference between the first half, seeking, and then Christ will be revealed to you. The difference, seeking, do I need to give up pot, crack? Do I need to give up pot? And that voice just being revealed.
Yeah, that's in that transition right there, before you have died.
Just to bring it back to the
So seeking is something that you do where you're active, and just being open is where you're just opening yourself to have things revealed.
But you need to find a balance and find ways to do both, because that's the other thing.
You know, Matthew 6, Jesus says, when you pray, don't be like the hypocrites who stand on the corners. You know, this external religiosity, right? When you pray, go inside. Go in your room and shut the door. And be there with your Father who's in secret, who sees in secret. Okay? You know, I feel like that's my call. That's the call that I'm hearing that I hear over and over again today. I mean, over and over every day. Go inside and shut the door. You know, all those distractions, all the other voices, the voices of the programs and of the agendas, of everybody's agendas, you know, shut the door, you know, and listen for the voice of the one who's there in secret, okay, and respond to that voice.
Well, that's what Lamentations 3 says that you read a while ago. Wait, pray quietly, sit alone in silence. Mm-hmm.
Thing that helped me, and a friend of mine used to really laugh about it, was when we can admit that we don't know, you know, we don't have the answers, we don't know, then we're open to God's guidance. Until we can admit that we don't know, we've got a preconceived notion about what should be, and what I can do, what I can't do, and whatever, and we're not really open to the true possibilities.
It's a transition from a dominant theology to this way of Jesus, or theology of glory to theology of cross.
All right, well,
Can I say one quick thing I just noticed about the scripture? The first half of scripture should come after the second, because the first half of scripture is if you have been raised with Christ, which is what happens when Christ is revealed.
And it assumes that you've been dead if you're raised with Christ.
So it should begin with, you've died. Yeah. So, I mean, the scripture should begin with, you've died, and your life is hidden. And then after, you know, after Christ is revealed, then you've been raised, and that at that point, you can start seeking.
Well, maybe they assume that since you're baptized, right?
Well, I'm just thinking linguistics.
But I agree with you.
I just noticed that the if there. Kind of been skipping over the if there.
Yeah.
If something has a sense of sins, too, mm-hmm. since you have been raised with Christ, secretly, whatever. I know when I heard that, I was like, wow, really? That changes a lot. You know, I'm not quite sure that's the case here.
You know, this is a fun way. It's a freer way, but it's a more satisfying way because it's authentic. It allows the possibility of an authentic spirituality, an authentic activism. That is also something that's livable. Okay. Which is the theme of our whole session. You know, working out a livable faith. A human faith, you know. So anyway, feel free to read this if you want. This goes into more detail about kind of how you can follow Jesus through the scriptures a bit, but of course with all the cautions that we've talked about.
You know, there's just that one verse on the back, we already read it, but I think for me, if I want to think about church, that's the one I think about on the top of page 2. Then Jesus went about all the cities and villages, teaching in their synagogues, proclaiming the good news of the kingdom, curing every disease and every sickness. And when he saw the crowds, he had compassion for them because they were harassed and helpless, like sheep without a shepherd. That's just an incredible verse. What a vision of church. Thanks for the week.
Thank you.
Thank you.